Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Are you someone who watches every true crime documentary the day that it releases and then find yourself always wanting to know more, Googling the timelines, red flags, and then falling into the social media rabbit hole? Well, I'm here to do all of that for you, bringing the facts, theories, and details that no one else is covering on my hit true crime podcast, Serialistly with Annie Elise. Whether it's everything with the Idaho 4 case, now that the documents are unsealed, or shocking cases you've never heard of, packed with love triangles, cults, and twists you won't see coming. With over 1 million downloads a week, I break it down for you just like your best friend would. Serialistly with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.
Lock your doors. Close the blinds. Change your passwords. This is the Dry Cleaner Cast. Welcome to the Dry Cleaner Cast, a podcast that takes a new look at the war on terror, its legacy, and espionage in the 21st century. This podcast is written, edited, and presented by Chris Carr.
Some of the best fiction is inspired by fact. So on today's podcast, we're joined by author and journalist Robert Delaney. We discuss his new book, The Wounded Muse, which is set in pre-Olympic China, and we take a look at the political issues that inspired that book. I hope you enjoy this episode.
Opinions expressed by guests on this podcast do not necessarily represent those of the filmmakers and sponsors of the film, The Dry Cleaner.
Robert, welcome to the Dry Cleaner Cast.
Thank you, Chris. It's great to be talking to you.
It's great to have you here. Just for the benefit of our audience who may not be familiar with you and your work, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes. Well, I've been a correspondent in China, working in China for several years, or I had been. Those were about 11 years altogether between the years of 1992 and the very end of 2006. So it sort of it represented a large chunk of my career as a journalist. And during that time, I was working for Dow Jones Newswires and also Bloomberg News.
Excellent. And what are you up to at the moment?
I left journalism for a few years after I left China and wound up going back to school. I then wound up in marketing and PR for a couple of years, and then an opportunity came for me to work as the U.S. correspondent for the South China Morning Post out of the U.S., based in New York, where I'm working now.
Yeah.
And that's what I've been doing for about the past year and a half.
Excellent, excellent. Well, you've written this fantastic novel called The Wounded Muse. Can you tell us a little bit about what the book's about?
Well, first, thanks for that description. I appreciate it. The book is based on actual events, but I ended up, my decision was to make it more, to fictionalize it and just to bring up the drama a bit. But the key kind of inciting event is the disappearance of a documentary filmmaker. This is a mainland Chinese person who moved back to China from the U.S. and was working on a project that the government didn't like. He disappears, and then it's his friends or his social circle around him have to figure out what to do. And that's the primary conflict.
And what was it that sort of drew you to writing this story in particular?
I think all of the years that I was in China, I had been toying with the idea of writing. And this event, when my friend did disappear, it kind of became obvious that this would be, it might sound insensitive to say a great peg, because at the time nothing seemed very great about it, but. Afterwards, after the situation was more or less resolved, I just thought that it was a great peg for a story about what's going on in China, And it served to give me something around which I could weave this story of people living in Beijing and living through this incredible economic and physical transformation, and how it affected their psychology, and how it affected their lives.
Yeah, and the kind of the backdrop to this book is set before the 2008 Olympics, isn't it? And in the book, one of the key things that the protagonist is investigating is the redevelopment of housing prior to the Olympics, and this kind of situation where buildings are kind of marked for demolition and residents are kind of forced out of their own homes. Can you just talk to us a bit about this?
Sure. Well, a lot of Beijing was built following 1949 after the revolution. Hmm. So at that time, there was a lot of work unit housing. And it's very nondescript kind of housing that often didn't have good plumbing. The heat was not very good. And so just ugly buildings. And I think the Beijing government, obviously, they wanted to put the best face forward for Beijing, because the Olympics were going to be such, a coming out party, if you will, in terms of China's emergence. And it was very important for the Chinese to have the city presentable. So this sort of housing just wasn't working in terms of the image that they wanted. So so they just embarked on, as they had been doing for quite a while leading up to the Olympics. They had been demolishing large tracts of these neighborhoods and replacing them with more market-oriented, modern buildings, not only residential, but in some areas closer into the center, really just hotels, office buildings, things like that. Things that are good for the city in one respect, but not so good for the city in another respect.
And what happened to the kind of the residents of the building that was being demolished?
It's not like they publicized the details, but from what I gathered and what I'd heard was that residents were given a subsidy. And they were given then either assigned or given preferential treatment along with their subsidy to move into these very expansive residential housing projects that were moving outside of the fifth ring. Beijing is sort of all centered around these ring roads, and so they were kind of pushed much further out. And to be fair, a lot of Beijing residents were okay with this because they were getting some financial help to live in a more modern home, but not all of them like that. There was a community, of course, that had developed in these sorts of housing projects over the decades. As they did that, the reactions were different because everyone is in a different situation financially, and everyone was in a different situation philosophically about what was happening. But regardless of how they felt about it, it was going to get done, because China is a very top-down kind of place where there isn't any discussion about what's going to happen, and ultimately everyone has to go.
Yeah. I remember in your book, I think because the residents, am I right in thinking they were only notified by a kind of marking that was placed on the building. Is that right?
Yes. There's a character that stands for demolition, and you would just kind of wake up one day, and maybe you're on your way to work, or I was on my way to work, and then I would see, okay, there's the character spray painted all over this set of buildings in red, and that just meant that, I guess in the next month or two, maybe three, I'm not sure, they're all going to disappear. I wonder what's going up next. And of course, it's going to be some kind of mixed-use development, office buildings, residential, commercial, luxury, if it's luxury brands, if you're closer into the center of the city.
Yeah. I suppose if you live there, it's not a great thing to wake up to, is it? You leave your house in the morning to see it's going to be demolished.
Right, yeah. Again, this is sort of work unit housing. So as a foreigner, some foreigners could live there, but it was difficult to get that kind of housing because it was already occupied.
Yeah.
So it's hard to know exactly what people were thinking when they woke up and, you know, walked out of the house and saw the character and thought, okay, well, I guess we're getting, they may have been given the heads up before the characters were spray painted, perhaps. But in any case, I think everyone sort of understood that that meant that they were relocating.
Yeah. It feels quite dramatic. I must admit, I wouldn't be too thrilled if that happened to my place, unless I got a better place afterwards. But but there we go.
Well, I mean, again, some were unhappy about it, and there were occasional demonstrations that would pop up kind of surreptitiously and kind of disperse kind of quickly, but. You know, it's as I said. To be fair, some people were perfectly fine, perfectly happy to move into a new building that had proper heat, proper plumbing, and air conditioning.
Yeah. Well, it's a silly question. You kind of touched upon it. Why were the 2008 Olympics so important for the Chinese government?
I think it was because 2008 was maybe just seen as the turning point where China had developed. To the point where they felt that it was worth advertising themselves as kind of having arrived, and no longer being a poor nation, having arrived sort of culturally, and it's just sort of a form of self-respect and a form of face. I think that the government wanted, they wanted more recognition that. That the government itself had worked very hard to alleviate poverty in the country, to give many more people in the country better economic opportunities, and this was the most obvious way to do it because during the Olympics you've got the whole world watching. And so to give an international audience, both those arriving in the country to watch the Olympics themselves and also those seeing it play out on TV, it was sort of the perfect opportunity, and the timing was right for China to put on this display and this more. They wanted to show the world that it was that they were a modern country and that they were a very dignified country.
Yeah, and so coming back to your book for a moment, so your protagonist is a documentary filmmaker interviewing people about the sort of negative side of this modernization. He must have really fallen out of favor with the government, which led to his detention, so to speak.
Right. So in real life, the events that happened that I experienced, my friend was actually working on a different subject, and the idea to have him working on this was because there was a lot of debate among residents, and as I mentioned, there were occasionally protests that would flare up and disperse quickly within Beijing about this. So I knew that there was a lot of concern about it, and that some people in Beijing wanted to do something about it and slow it down, or at least have more of a say in how this redevelopment was done. But despite all that, none of these views were ever really aired.
Yeah.
So that's why it would have been whoever was trying to make a difference in this matter really wouldn't have been able to be very visible in China.
Yeah. What I really like the approach you take in your book with the kind of the different timelines. It kind of reminded me a little bit of Alex Garland's The Tesseract. And I really like that sort of style. And I was wondering out of curiosity, did you have any particular authors who inspired you to pursue writing a novel?
You know, the funny thing about the novel is that it started off more as it was very descriptive, and it was very interior with the characters, and it was very much there was a lot of dialogue among these different characters about how they felt about China and its development with different perspectives. And when I shopped it around to publishers and I got feedback, the feedback was, this needs to be more dramatic. We need more suspense. So that's when I decided it was no longer going to be a piece of creative nonfiction, and it was going to be it was just going to be more of a thriller. So, I'm not an avid reader of thrillers. So, I kind of had to think about what I had seen in films, because I didn't read a lot, because it's just not my tendency to read thrillers. And I thought a lot about, there was one movie, in fact, that really kind of inspired me. It came out in 2006. It's called The Lives of Others.
Oh, yeah. Great film.
Yeah, a German film. And it's the same idea. It's the government kind of watching, and these dissident characters who are trying to navigate through that. And a lot of the ideas that came out of that movie kind of inspired me to bring into the book.
Yeah, now you've said that, I can see that actually. Yeah, especially with the sort of surveillance theme that's kind of going on in the background.
Right.
Yeah.
Like what we're doing? Connect with us on Twitter at DryCleanerCast. Support the show by becoming a DryCleanerCast Patreon subscriber today. Go to patreon.com/DryCleanerCast. That's patreon.com/DryCleanerCast.
I'd like to paint a picture for us a bit about Chinese politics. And I was wondering if it's possible, if you could give us a sort of dummy's guide to Chinese politics, like how the government is sort of structured and how it sort of came to be that way.
China, right after the revolution, well, leading up to and then right after the revolution, the Chinese politics was pretty much just dominated by one person. It was Mao Zedong. And he also, of course, had some of his aides, like Zhou Enlai. But it was predominantly Mao Zedong and what he wanted. And that led to, by the late 50s, there was the Great Leap Forward, which led to a terrible famine. And then after several years of that, I think Mao Zedong felt like he was possibly becoming more vulnerable. So he let loose the Cultural Revolution, which was a very traumatic and chaotic time for the Chinese, which sort of led the country, both the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution really led the country backward in time for a couple of decades. So after Mao passed away, you had the emergence of Deng Xiaoping in the late, who set forth the a period of economic reform. And what Deng Xiaoping did was he changed the constitution so that the government would no longer be, they would no longer allow this sort of one person rule, which, because he saw the kind of chaos that can cause. And so the government became more of a lead by committee. That would be sort of the central committee in the Politburo, and that led to this period of tremendous economic growth. So you had, it was not only economic growth, but also there was sort of this vacillation between reform, all sorts of reform, political reform along with the economic reform. It led to a lot more freedom for the Chinese people in terms of their choices. And ability to make money. So that was really the case. Of course, you had the blip of the Tiananmen Square protests of 1989. That was obviously a chaotic period. But by and large, from the late 1970s all the way up until really around the time of the Olympics, you had this general trend of opening up and allowing more ideas to filter in, allowing more debate among academics and government officials about how much the ideas of Western liberal democracies China could accept or adopt. And things have started to change in recent years. Things have started to turn a little bit back towards the orientation of the time of Mao Zedong. You've got Xi Jinping as president now. Now I'm not going to suggest at all that it is completely gone back to that period. But you do have more of a tightening up about what you can say, about what Chinese people are exposed to in the media. You have the there's much more the great China firewall around the internet is it's much tighter than it was 10 years ago. So we're kind of in this period now where I think I think the jury is out on where this is going, whether or not it will continue to move in this direction, or is this just part of the vacillation that China's been going through for the past 30 years or so? So that's kind of where it stands at the moment. We've got a government that is, all along, it's been one-party rule. However, during the past 30 years, that one-party rule has actually accommodated different viewpoints. Although over the past couple of years, those viewpoints are not allowed to be as diverse as they had been. So now there's a lot of debate around whether or not it's going to stay where it is, it's going to continue going in the direction it's been in the past 2 years, or will it start to gradually swing back the way it has over the past 30 years?
Mm. Can you just quickly describe how one-party rule kind of works to our listeners?
Yes, it's one-party rule, but I think there's one example that really explains this well. I remember it was back in the late 90s when I was working in Shanghai, and Zhu Rongji at the time, he was the premier, he was very much a reformer. He wanted to reform the state-owned enterprises, and he had a lot of power for many years.
Yeah.
And for some reason, his name was not appearing in the media. His name was not appearing in any of the headlines in any of the state-owned newspapers for a period of, I forget how long it was, but the stock markets in China started just plummeting. Every day they kept going limit down, and it was because many people saw that people expected that Zhu Rongji was going to be purged. Mm. So after about a week of limit down losses on the stock market, all of a sudden, Zhu Rongji, his name is appearing everywhere in state media. And I think that's an example of, and the reason I mention that is because it's an example of how you have one-party rule, okay, but there is the government gets input from, it gets popular input. In this case, the input is really from the business community, the entrepreneurs and whatnot, who are basically sending the signal, sell China and get the hell out.
Mm.
And I think the government responded that way. So I guess the point I'm making is that in one-party rule does not mean that there's only one answer,
yeah,
and one direction that anyone's going to take.
Do we know what kind of China's political goals and aims for the future are, and what and how they're kind of pursuing them?
Well, depending on who you're talking to, there's a lot of debate around this right now, mm, because, as you know, there's so much friction between China and the U.S.
Yeah.
at the moment. And also, there's also a lot of friction between China and many other countries at this point. This is happening in Australia, and I think it's a reaction to, in very very recently, China has been has really put itself out as having arrived economically and quote taking the center stage in the world, and that sort of, I think, led a lot of people to think that, well, China is really expecting to become the dominant country in the 21st century and going forward for, you know, who knows how long. Now, that's caused, this has caused so many problems for the Chinese government and the Chinese foreign ministry in particular, because there's now so much pushback. There's now lawmakers, governments, policymakers in other countries that they have to deal with are now coming up with measures to sort of limit investment, to limit the amount of participation that Chinese students are allowed in their countries. And so there really is a reassessment within the halls of power in Beijing now to edit their message a bit. And to say no, when they say center stage, they're talking about center stage along with many other powerful countries. They're not saying center stage as in we are the Middle Kingdom again. Of course, many people might know the name for China is Zhongguo, which means Middle Kingdom, And I think it's that middle kingdom mentality that has that is both in China and outside of China for people who are aware of it, that have this concern that China wants to just simply reassume the position they had before colonial imperialism, where China was the largest economy in the world. And I think at one point, I'm not sure which century it was, again, it would have been before European colonialism, China accounted for something like 40 to 45% of the world's economic output. And that had been the case for centuries. So, and really everyone else was kind of just many other countries and kingdoms were kind of vassal states to China. And so I think the concern is that China expects to reassume that position. Now, how many people in the senior leadership in China sort of have this goal? I don't know. The official line is that no one in China, no one in the government thinks that that's realistic anymore. But then again, there are quite a few moves that China's making that have given many policymakers in the West and other countries the impression that that's what they're intending to do.
Yeah, because there's no shortage of books sort of talking about the idea that China wants to become the sort of number one dominant superpower.
Right, right. And as for whether they're intending to do that, is not clear. But you know, it's certainly in my position, I've talked to some members of the foreign ministry officials who say, and I think very genuinely, they say this is not a realistic thing in the 21st century. It's not realistic for China to expect to be in that position again. So I think there's a bit of interplay within the government about what their ambitions should be.
Can you just talk to us a bit about US and Chinese relations today? Because you mentioned before, there's a lot of sort of back and forth going on at the moment.
Yeah, I would say US-China relations today they're really on the cusp of being as bad as they have ever been since the reestablishment of diplomatic relations, or the establishment of diplomatic relations in 1979 between Washington and Beijing. And it's not clear when or how they will pull back, or the two sides will pull back from the situation there is, because at the moment there's no dialogue to end the trade war. I mean, as you know, they have the U.S. side put punitive tariffs on a huge portion of Chinese imports. China responded in kind. There's another set of tariffs that are going into effect in about a week's time, and China has announced further tariffs. So the U.S. and China are officially in a trade war. At the same time, there's a lot more confrontation about what China's military is doing in the South China and the East China Sea. Whereas China had said 5 years ago the activity that they were doing around these atolls and these reefs in the South China Sea, they said it was really just to support fishing operations and it was not anything about the military. Well, now there is military equipment being installed on these atolls, and of course the U.S. government, the Pentagon, is reacting to this. So, in a word, it's not good at the moment. And the diplomats on both sides diplomatic efforts seem to have stalled for the moment, and it's not clear when they're going to figure out a way out of this.
Well, let's move into hopefully a more slightly positive thing. I don't know. Life in China today. Because I wanted to get a bit more of an idea of what daily life is like in China. So it's a bit of a broad question, but can you kind of paint us a picture of how life, or how society is divided up, what's kind of on people's minds and what kind of goals people are pursuing and, you know, sort of just general life in China today?
Yeah, sure. One thing just to point out that I was working in China up until the end of 2006. So
yeah,
I haven't lived there for about 12 years, but I have had a couple of trips back since then. I keep in touch with friends there.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say if you're talking about sort of your average mainland Chinese, I don't think much has changed though in the past 12 years. It's really, I think there's an overall sense among Chinese people that they're very aware that the country had been set back several decades by what had happened in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. So there's just this general, everyone's kind of in pursuit of their a better lot, as it were. Being able to own a home, ideally being able to own a car, these things are all very important. And everyone it does kind of feel like everyone is in a race and everyone is stressed out in trying to make sure that they secure their economic situation. And I think there's a couple of reasons behind that. Number one, as I mentioned, everyone's aware of how far China had fallen behind during that period that they've pulled out of now. And on the other hand, while the government has reformed enough to give people much more economic freedom, more than they had in not only the years since the revolution, but even before then, even though they have this freedom, they don't have the political freedoms that many people have in other countries. So I think most Chinese would say that they're securing their economic situation is crucial in order to survive. And because you've got 1.4 billion people all kind of in this race, the feeling in China is, at least when I was living there, it's just, how do I say, it can be kind of exhausting, I think. And I think people are quite have, I don't think the Chinese none of them want to go back to the 70s and the 60s. So this is certainly a much better situation than what they were living through then. But at the same time, I just sort of, just in general, people seem kind of, well, they seem, on the one hand, they seem optimistic, but on the other hand, they seem a little bit exhausted also.
Yeah. And what was it that drew your interest to China?
My interest in China was probably maybe started when I was in university and I took a Kung Fu class and I had gotten into that so much that I decided when I was going to do an independent study in the American Studies Department about martial arts in America. So when I started doing that, of course, my independent study advisor said, well, if you're going to do an independent study about martial arts in America, you need to understand the origins of the martial arts or the origins of Kung Fu. So that was my entree into China. And the more I studied about it, the more fascinated I was. And then, of course, there was the student protest of 1989 in Tiananmen Square that I just found, and that just really put the country in kind of vivid focus for me. And I think the juxtaposition of this tremendously beautiful philosophy behind Kung Fu, and also having to learn about the other theological traditions about China, Taoism, Confucianism, Buddhism, that those ideas juxtaposed against what had happened in 1989 just made me think, I just need to, I need to go there. I need to understand what's going on. And so it was at that point when I asked the grandmaster of the Kung Fu studio where I was. He worked some connection to get me into a university in Anhui province, which is a bit further inland. It's more rural. It's kind of poor. At the time, it was kind of poor, in a city called Wuhu, which whenever I tell people that, I always get a laugh. Yes, I studied Chinese in Wuhu. So that was it. It was just really this broad sweep of this tremendous history, this tremendous culture, these belief systems and these philosophical systems that I thought were so interesting that kind of led me to China. All of those things, and then how does it turn out to become a communist country? I just kind of wanted to figure all of that out.
Yeah, because it's a country of such rich history that sort of, I wonder, if, you know, communism sort of just pushed it to the side, hasn't it?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the sad things. I mean, obviously, China today is very different from the political system that I feel comfortable living in. Mm. But despite that, I don't, I certainly wouldn't begrudge Chinese for the system that they're living in. And at the end of the day, there are 1.4 billion Chinese people. I always say this, 1.4 billion Chinese people, it's up to them to decide what sort of political system they want to live in.
Yeah.
If they're happy with this, then this is fine. I would just say that's, I find all of this interesting, how all of it comes together, the history, the ideas, the art, the culture, how does it all end up where it is now?
Yeah. Yeah.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Eastern and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
So I was talking to a friend who just come back from China recently, and we ended up, usually because most of my topics end up talking about espionage and what have you, we ended up talking about social media in China, because you mentioned it before about the, I can't remember how you described it, was it the Great Firewall of China, is that what they call it? And we were talking about social media, and he was showing me this app called WeChat, where it seems to be a portal for everything, and it all goes through this app, which obviously leads to, it means things can be filtered, but also, from my understanding, things can be monitored as well. And he was telling me about this thing called social credit. Are you familiar with social credit? And if you are,
I'm familiar with social credit. And what I would say is that there are many different opinions about what it is and whether or not it's a danger. Some Chinese friends have said, look, this is because there are, this is to deal with things like people who, we've all seen YouTube videos of Chinese tourists acting badly, right? You've seen, they sort of end up going viral. I think this is a response by the government to remind Chinese people that when they go abroad, there's a certain manner in which they need to conduct themselves. And I mean, I think what people need to keep in mind is that China has gone from real agricultural country to being much closer to a first world country and a wealthy country in such a short period of time. And I mean, it's much like in the 19, there's the term the ugly American, right? And that comes from Americans kind of built up wealth very quickly in the 20th century. And so you had them going abroad and you had Americans going to Europe. And of course, the French and the Germans would kind of roll their eyes at the way Americans acted because it was very different. And I think this is really just kind of the same situation playing out with Chinese. So to go back to the question about social credit, I think the government's very aware of this, and they want a way to make sure that people are behaving in a way that's consistent with the stature that they see the country has achieved. So there's that. But others, of course, point out that there's also a financial component. Obviously, if you're not managing your money well, if you're constantly going into bankruptcy, there has to be some kind of repercussion, and there has to be some kind of stick and a carrot to make sure that people are minding their financial situations properly. So there's all of that, which many Chinese people would say, well, they don't have a problem with making this other system that is an extra measure to make Chinese more act more responsibly. But then the question comes in, how much does the content that people are posting on social media, how much is this coming into play when it comes to determining their social credit score? And this is the big question, I think, that people are wrestling with, because it's, as far as I know, I'm not there, so I'm not too much of an expert on this either, but I think it's not very clear at this point how much of your social credit is tied to things like, you know, disruptive behavior, of financial irresponsibility, and how much of it is tied to what you're thinking and what you're expressing politically. It's not clear at this point, and I think the concern is that there's going to the system will, if it's not already, perhaps will take too much of the latter into account in determining your social credit score, and how much how much does your social credit, if you slip up somewhere where you're not really aware of whether or not you stepped over a line politically, how much does that damage, does that permanently damage you in terms of your career or other aspects? It's not clear. It's being debated.
No, and I know there was a case I was just looking into yesterday, where a gentleman whose name Zhang had posted 274 posts on social media between 2010 and 2015, on Twitter and WeChat that were considered by the government as attacks and smears against the government, and apparently this earned him 15 years in prison. Just based on his social media posts, which is pretty dramatic.
That's kind of draconian. Yeah. I would say. I don't. And it's hard to know. Is this an aberration? Is this or is this something that's being applied more broadly? And are there many, many more cases of this that are not coming to light? I don't know. It's just hard to tell, especially because I'm not living there these days.
Yeah. I'm sure if it is becoming common, we probably will hear more over time, won't we? One question I was going to ask you, but was about sort of self-censorship and whether that's becoming a common practice in China. I don't know if you have any sort of thoughts on that.
Self-censorship, I mean, most Chinese understand the parameters of this system they live in, and I think they have a good sense of where the boundaries are. So I think in many ways many Chinese will self-censor in that they're not going to be as outspoken on social media as you would see people in the US or the UK or in many other Western liberal democracies. For sure, the Chinese will be more conservative about expressing their views. So there is self censorship on that level. But I think a lot of people who are not familiar with China would be surprised at the level of openness that Chinese will express amongst themselves. So whether it's just sort of sitting out in front of their shop, talking to their neighbors. It's no longer the country where they've got where everyone's spying on everyone else, making sure you're not allowed to, making sure you're not saying this or not saying that. But all of the years that I'd lived there, I was more surprised at how open and expressive people were when they were just sitting next to you talking about the government, than I was surprised by how much they would censor themselves.
Yeah. Because I know in your book, the intelligence services sort of play a background role monitoring the activities of your protagonist. Is it Quang? and
Qiang.
Sorry, and one thing I was quite interested was: is it common for the Chinese authorities sort of to step in and tell journalists not to pursue a topic for a story? Because there's actually a particular scene in your book where he's interviewing a gentleman about sort of an old political story, and his and the place he's actually recording the interview in has actually been bugged.
Yes. Well, I would say this. When I was I was working for financial newswires. I was working for Dow Jones, and I was also working for Bloomberg when I was in China. So I was always covering macroeconomic policy. I was covering currency issues. I was covering these large listed companies and what they were doing. So I wasn't really monitored, but I do remember once there was one of the guys in our bureau who covered politics in China. He was on vacation, so I kind of stepped in to do this one story about Taiwan, and I was contacting a U.S. Diplomat, or I was calling. I had to call a U.S. diplomat who had recently been in Taiwan just to find out. Okay, well, what did you guys talk about? What was the meeting about? And in the middle of the conversation, the line just cut off. So, you know, and I just sort of thought, well, I guess I'm not doing that story. I mean, that happened to me all of once in all the years that I lived there. But I think it just sort of showed that they're, you know, the Chinese government doesn't get into the lives of most people there. But of course, the foreign media, they're very sensitive about what the foreign media and what foreign journalists in China are doing. So they do keep tabs on them. You know, I would say on the other hand, I'm pretty sure that the U.S. government keeps tabs on reporters at the Chinese state-owned media who are working in the U.S., you know, who is one more more invasive than the other? I'm not sure, but for sure, I know some of my friends who were reporters in China who were covering politics, who would tell me stories about how they would get messages from time to time, just from bumping into people on the street. I know in one case, this one friend of mine who worked for a foreign newswire, who said that she was a little bit spooked because she was on her way to an interview, and then someone just intercepted her and said, someone in just plain clothes saying, you probably don't want to do this interview. So that sort of thing would play out among foreign reporters. But it wasn't. No, it's not. You know, it was never. It was just never very overt.
No.
And that you know, that case was an exception, but you know, there's just a handful of these cases that I was aware of when I was living and working there as a journalist, and I didn't see interference a whole lot.
No, because there's certainly in the book there's a theme of there's a character who has spoken to someone in a bar, and then she's given a recording of that conversation later on. And things like that. Was that based on truth, or was that just a bit of
That was based on an actual event.
Wow.
Yes, that was based on. This is based on a story that was that kind of made the rounds among foreign journalists in Beijing. There's another scene where two guys are in a hotel room, and then there's a flash that comes from behind the mirror because obviously someone had taken a photo and was planning to use it as blackmail. That actually comes directly from a story of a friend of mine who was a diplomat for a European country, and he was in Beijing as part of very sensitive negotiations with the Chinese government. That event goes back to 1995. As for whether or not that sort of thing still happens here in you know 2018, I don't know. I think there are more. I think the technology has become better, and maybe you wouldn't see that now. But that incident comes directly from a story of a friend of mine.
We're just coming close to wrapping up now. So what do you think the future holds for Western and Chinese relations?
Well, I'm trying to be an optimist about this because, and the reason that, I mean, I think there's a lot of reason for pessimism and concern about the situation that China face off with the West at the moment is in. But the reason that I would side with optimism is just because China has integrated itself economically with the West so deeply that I think if China and the U.S. and if China and the West in general don't figure out a way to accommodate each other, you're really talking about going China having to go back to much closer to the days that people remember, where days of chaos and days of uncertainty. I just don't think mainland Chinese people in general want to go back there. I think they've seen the benefits. I think they appreciate the benefits of integration with the rest of the world. And I don't think that they want, I think Chinese people in general do not want to go back to a position where they're more isolated. And I guess on the part of the West, I don't think that that the West wants this conflict with China either. It's what can I say? It's just a feeling I have, and maybe I'll be proven to be wrong, but I would lay my money on sort of an overall general accommodation between China and the West, simply because the world is so integrated, and pulling that integration apart would cause too much. Would cause more uncertainty than most people are willing to accept.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Robert, thank you so much for joining me today. Where can listeners sort of find out more about you and your work and your book?
The book is available for pre-order on Amazon. So if you just you can just Google Robert Delaney, The Wounded Muse, which is the title of the book, and you'll find it on Amazon. It's being published by a small Canadian publishing house called Mosaic Press. So in Canada, it should be more widely available, sort of on the bookshelves, I hope. And then my Twitter handle, which is mostly my work as a journalist, is at RF Delaney, so that's at RFDELANEY, and then if you wanted to follow what I'm writing, you can just look South China Morning Post Robert Delaney, and my stuff will come up. So that's probably the best way to follow me.
Excellent. Well, Robert, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, great. Chris, thanks very much. I really appreciate your interest in the book, and I appreciate all of your questions. So thank you for that.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you for coming on.
Like what we're doing? Support the show by becoming a Dry Cleaner Cast Patreon subscriber today. Go to patreon.com/drycleanercast. For more information about the podcast, visit our website at drycleanercast.co.uk. Thanks for listening.
Has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes. Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Hi there. My name is Annie Elise, aka your True Crime BFF and host of the podcast. Seriously. I have been a true crime enthusiast forever, but I wished somebody would break down the cases for me like a friend, giving all the details and discussing every twist and turn. So I decided to create a podcast that does just that. Seriously with Annie Elise is topping the charts with over 1 million weekly downloads. I do the deep dives in these cases so you don't have to, diving into all the raw details, saying what we're all thinking, and in a conversational way, just like having a conversation with your best friend. So join me and let's talk all things true crime. Seriously with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.